There are people who talk about God as if he were a next door neighbor. They speak his name as easily as they say Betty and Bob. They know exactly how God feels about any controversial topic you bring up. There are other people whom I like better, who speak quietly and with reverent caution about the eternal. God, says one of them, is an unutterable sigh in the innermost depths of the soul. Poignant longing, humble vagueness. I like both qualities in that definition. There are people who love God because they have had every good thing the world has to offer. They are lucky. So God's in his heaven. All's right with the world. There are others born crippled, blind, deaf, poor, hopeless, who grow up and split into two camps in their notions of God. One group loves him despite what has happened and hopes for strength to make the best of a bad life. The other group hates him for being an indifferent tyrant who seems completely blind to all the suffering in the world. And among these last, there are some who accuse God of indifference with their minds, and then in the presence of human love and tenderness, find him with their hearts. I saw a tough and gentle poem the other day called Room 247. A room, you learn quickly, in a hospital. Seeing his body wasted as a bombed landscape, hair falling out in yellow tufts, I tried to think of some defense of God, something convincing to prove there was more between him and death than a machine on tracks in the ceiling and the silent river of chemicals flushing his veins. Watching him in drugged sleep, I wanted to present the case for God, but found myself arguing on the wrong side. God, I thought, this is no way to treat your creation. But instead, saw something infinitely lovable in the curve of his dying hands, translucent as lilies against the white sheet, and an unbearable tenderness in the slender ridge of his body beneath the cover. And suddenly there was in the room a keen sense of God, a saving presence beyond mind or any argument. The woman who wrote that poem, watching a husband or father die, stood in both camps, angry at first with God, then unable because of the ache of love and beauty to keep from finding him again. But there are others so wounded by the cruelties and injustices of life that they never get past being angry. And you must remember that they are angry because they are good people, because they love others and cannot comprehend how a decent God would create a world with as much undeserved suffering as there is in this one. They represent the old classic argument. God is said to be all good and all powerful. If he is all good, he would have to be grieved by the suffering of millions of innocent lives. If he is also all-powerful, why didn't he create a better kind of world? It is a profoundly disturbing dilemma for intelligent and sensitive people. They say, if I had the power to do anything I liked, I would see to it that no bright-eyed, laughing, happy children would ever get leukemia or be buried under the ash of a volcano or burned alive in the fires that follow an earthquake. How then can I worship a God who is said to have the power to make a different world, but didn't? It won't do any good to say to these people, oh, but God's thoughts are higher than ours, and we have no right to question, because the only way we can possibly get any notion of God's love is by analogy with our own love. Every day for years, I spoke to a colleague with blind and unsightly eyes, maimed at birth by an innocent mistake. I taught a student deformed by a drug mistakenly prescribed for his mother. I have a friend who suffers torment from a genetic defect over which he had no control. My limited love, a poor thing in comparison with God's, tells me I would not let such things happen if only I had the power to stop them. But God, we are told, has the power. He simply chooses, for reasons best known to himself, to do nothing about the vast burden of pain and suffering that spins through the days and nights on this planet. Tornadoes and earthquakes are inevitable, given the way this world is put together. But why should it ever have been put together that way? 100,000 people die in one earthquake, including innocent children. Does this not touch the being we call God? If there is nothing he cannot do, why should he allow evils to continue that any one of us would stop? A woman is sent to jail for poisoning her husband to collect his insurance. But the rattlesnake and the cobra are said to be God's creation, and they have killed thousands over the centuries. Over and over, someone points out, the Creator habitually does on a vast scale things for which we are sent to prison or put to death. Some people are appalled to hear those arguments spoken aloud, but the Bible had no reluctance at all about raising the questions, both in the book of Job and in the book of Ecclesiastes. Faith is not very strong or grown up that has not confronted the problem. I once had a crusty older friend who used to say that the main reason he wished to go to heaven was so he could get God off in a corner and ask him some questions. I can only respond from where I live, but if I were God, I'd like that man. And I'd welcome him to a real debate. There is a new way of resolving the age-old dilemma, which says God may be all-loving, or he may be all-powerful, but he cannot be both at the same time and let a world like this continue. It has a technical name in theology, but I choose to share it in a letter from a thoughtful friend. Please listen. I grew up hearing about a God of love. I did not have a preacher who shouted about a distant or angry judge who condemns people to an eternal hell. The religious experiences that shaped my life were ones that taught me to love and help the people around me because God is love. I knew intellectually that God was supposed to be all-powerful, but power had nothing much to do with my faith. I simply didn't think about it much. But as I got older and came to know more and more about the undeserved evil, the unmerited suffering of the innocent in this world, I knew that the God whose love I had felt would not willingly cause or allow such senseless and unfair suffering. I've had people try to tell me that evil is really good in disguise. I can't buy the package. I mean, there is no point in dishonoring my own mind or in making the plain truth into a lie just to justify the God I believe in. The baby born with no immune system, condemned to an air bubble for a few years of grotesque life, for me to call that good is an utter impossibility. If it is somehow supposed to be an example of God's mysterious love, then there is no way I can make sense of anything, and I will stop trying. All I know for sure is what I mean by love, and my love would never allow an innocent child, a single innocent child, to suffer needlessly if I could prevent it. Well, fortunately, he says, for me at least, I discovered in my reading what is called process theology, which, to put it in a very simple way, argues that God is indeed all-loving, but God is not all-powerful. God is a friend who does all that can be done to defeat the world's pain and suffering, hurt by it as much as we are. He wants to change it, longs to change it, but has to work through me. His power is limited. He has to work through me. But tradition doesn't like this approach, I have found out. My friends make it clear that if God is not perfectly powerful in the way they want, if God cannot infallibly see and guarantee the happy outcome they want, then God is unimportant. We are all hung up on a God of power, even though we turn right around and say that the truest representation of God we know was tortured and crucified. And we claim God had no other way to save the world than by allowing this to happen. I interrupt his letter to add my own word of sympathy for his views. Our Father who art in heaven, we say, we think of God under the image of a father, but what are good parents like? What is a father? As children, we think that our parents know all, see all, control all. My daughter's trust went right up to the moment of her marriage, when her husband had to restrain his disbelieving, and I'm sure slightly mocking, smile when she said, "My daddy can do anything." I was once all powerful for her, as God has been all powerful in theology. But she learned by and by that I was not all powerful. She knew that I would do all I could to make life good for her, and that I would teach her to be caring and giving, but that there would be times when I could not help, could not intervene. So I am no longer all powerful. But I am still, I believe, to her, all loving. She knows that there is absolutely nothing I would not do for her out of my love that I am able to do. My power is limited, but my love is limitless. And so it is, finally, for their loving that we love our parents, not for the power we thought they had. This is, in the most simple form, what process theology says about God. He is divine love who would never willingly allow senseless suffering. He applauds when we find the cure to polio at long last, which, of course, if he were all powerful, he could, had he wished, have whispered into someone's ear a long, long time ago and saved millions from a painful, crippled life or from an early death. I suppose, my friend goes on, that process theology will not appeal to the average church member who has been cautioned all her life against asking questions about the nature of God and the reality of this world. But this God of love, limited in his power, has come to be very appealing to people I know who are both very bright and deeply compassionate. One of them said to me the other day, imagine two doctors who are caring for your sick child. One of them has the power to cure the child at the snap of his finger, but chooses not to. For some mysterious reason, he does not reveal. The other doctor lacks this power and admits it, but does everything she can to help your child. Nursing, cooling, covering, feeding, holding, loving. You come in one night, in fact, and she is sitting by your child's bed, holding the child's hand, weeping with compassion. You may beg that first doctor to use his infinite power because you are desperate for help. But when your child dies, the one you will embrace as you cry will be the second one. The one that couldn't overcome the disease, but shared the heartbreak and the darkness with you. What I'm saying, my friend concludes, is that power can make me feel fear and awe, but not love or real worship. Unilateral power cannot change me into a more sensitive or caring person, but love can. When I think of God, I have to think of a person hanging on a cross who cannot escape the ignorance and cruelty of the world, but offers grace and love as ways of overcoming. End of letter. But lest you think my friend to be some lonely eccentric, I will quote a minister who says that seeing God as limited has preserved his faith in God from almost sure destruction. An omnipotent God, he writes, does not need us. But a limited God calls without cease upon you and me in our own places and in our own lives. A limited God cannot do his work without us. The millions of men and women who strive to lead good lives are co-creators with him in making a better world. The voice that each of us hears within us, calling upon us to lead stronger, nobler lives, is the voice of God, beseeching our alliance. You don't have to believe a word of it, of course. This is a free church. We dislike dogma and enforce no creed. But here and there, and it is part of my purpose in this series to tell you this, there is some wounded heart that finds this approach to God has made faith possible that otherwise would have been lost in despair. I cannot even imagine a God who, knowing the reason, would mind our limiting his power, even if we were mistaken, in order to go on believing in his love. Next week, the search for God through silence. Please come back.